That was a short excerpt from the Charles Gounod opera Faust, which has been staged with some serious help from our guest today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by a sculptor, animator, video artist, composer, and now a production designer for the opera Faust. John Frame, welcome to Words and Pictures.
I'm really, really happy to be here. I love Portland, and I am so glad to be back. I just feel very at home here.
Well, you are bringing with you a production from the Lyric Opera in Chicago, the very well-regarded opera company. And this production of Faust had its operatic debut there. And this was also your operatic debut.
Yes, absolutely. And it's all as a direct result of having my exhibition up here in 2012 at the Portland Art Museum. Christopher Mataliano, who is the general director at the Portland Opera, saw the show there and chewed on an idea of approaching me about the possibility of designing something for them for a few months. And then he gave me a call, and we just really hit it off. And he proposed that I perhaps scout out a specific opera that I would like to work with. And Faust, of course, deals with similar issues that I'm trying to get to in my own work. So I was very attracted to the subject matter. My biggest reservation, of course, was having never done anything even remotely like this, I knew that I would need significant help. But I said yes to the proposal right away. And then I had a period of about a year where I did not hear back from Chris. These are long-term planned events, as events are in the art world. So I'm comfortable with the idea that sometimes it can be years before something actually happens. But during the first year of that period, without knowing that I would do Faust, I created approximately 20 characters and set elements related directly to the story. I became very, very fascinated by the history of the story. It goes, of course, we're dealing with Charles Gounod's 1859 version of the story, but it goes back to Goethe in Germany in the early, I think about 1825. And then it goes back significantly further than that. It's kind of a legendary, he's a legendary figure in, I believe he originates actually in Eastern Europe. And fascinatingly, he was kind of, my take on him is that he was kind of a traveling charlatan. He was a kind of a magician. But whoever he was, if he was in fact a living human being, a bunch of stories developed around him, and they combined magic and kind of religious mysticism and surrealism, and they were eventually collected into something called the Faust chapbooks. And those are, they were just very thin sort of flyers almost that when this guy would come to town, or later when traveling puppet show versions of this story would come to town, they would sell the stories in these little chapbook forms. And so they were eventually collated into a comprehensive collection of them. And I went back and I read all of those. They are all over the map. Goethe clearly took those stories and forged them into a powerful masterwork of German literature. And Gounod does his own treatment of it. And of course, now we're doing our own treatment of that, trying to make it completely contemporary.
Right. It's Goethe's version that we think of today when we talk about a Faustian bargain or a deal with the devil. But the way that you approach this work, you're going much deeper. You're going into how people spend their lives and sometimes waste their lives.
Absolutely. I think that's there are many basic human questions that are addressed in Faust, but the fundamental one, the core of the narrative, has to do with a person who gets to a point in his life. He happens to be an older person in most tellings of this story, but I think it can happen to any of us at any time. You don't have to be 65, you can be 45, you can be 25, where one day you realize that maybe you're going down the wrong pathway. Maybe you've invested a tremendous amount of time and energy and effort, as is in the case of Faust. He spent his entire life searching for something, searching for meaning, searching for, I think of it as looking for an answer from whatever you want to call it, God, the universe. He's seeking, he's reaching for that, and the universe never answers him back. And he realizes, I've missed everything here. I've missed love, I've missed sex, I've missed partying with people, I've missed everything that most human beings have an opportunity to experience. And so instead of calling on a job counselor or something, he summons the devil, and Mephistopheles appears on stage. One of the reasons this opera, I think, holds together so well among three that I can think of is that Mephistopheles is an intensely beautifully drawn character. He's very complex. He's charming. He's witty. He can be sinister. He can tell a joke. He's really a very well-rounded character whose ultimate goal is to steal your soul. And he just does it very charmingly.
And I'm sure we can see some stand-ins for Mephistopheles in our society nowadays.
Oh, yes. Some very large ones, of course. And I interestingly, at the very beginning of our collaboration on this project, it was right after the most recent national election, and we discussed the political implications for us as artists. Now, I'll speak only for myself in regard to this question, but my feeling is that in the face of difficult social and political circumstances, my job is actually to be the best artist that I can be. So I'm not interested in addressing political or social questions in my own work. But I really appreciate artists who answer that question in a slightly different way or even in a radically different way. My strategy is to be very subtle in the way I approach that, try to draw people into a meaningful experience in their lives and give them that. That's what I have to give, and I want to give it even more powerfully and more readily in light of the circumstances we're currently in.
You know, it's interesting. Americans often try to separate art and politics. And you hear, if you go over to Europe and you talk to people there, they say making art is a political act.
Yeah, I think it is a political act in many ways. I think it's frowned upon in certain levels of our culture. It's not really supported by the culture generally, and certainly not in the governmental forms. I mean, we have so much money in this country, and a fraction of it could be used to support artists and opera companies and dance companies and guerrilla theater. I mean, just a tiny bit of that money could do so much to enrich the culture. And for some reason, it just absolutely, well, for obvious reasons and for many and very complex reasons, I suppose, it doesn't happen. And I think the culture is weaker and more impoverished by that decision.
Well, let's talk about this production of Faust. The last time you were in Portland and we had an opportunity to talk, you were working on a very personal project. It was The Tale of the Crippled Boy, three fragments of a lost tale. It was an installation at Portland Art Museum with animation, with film, with puppets, with sets, and based very deeply on material that you mined from your own dream state.
Not exactly. It's a bit of an ambiguous thing that happened to me when this gigantic story emerged. I had been blocked for almost 5 years between 2000 and 2005. I could go to the studio day after day after day, and absolutely nothing was happening. There was just no connection between myself and my work that was intuitive. I could go out there and make an object, and I did a few commissions and things during that period. But that sense of being in flow in relationship to the work where it was just unfolding went away, and I'd never experienced that in the 20 previous years where my career was just going crazy, or going very well, I should say. After that period of 5 years of being blocked, one day I just said, I can't keep doing this. I'm going to give up. I am not an artist anymore. I talked to my wife about it, and I just said, I'll go back to building cabinets or working on houses or something else, physical, having to do with carpentry skills probably. And that was it. I just resigned myself to that being the end of the story. And then I went to bed a couple of nights later. I went to bed at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was kind of pushed out of the sleep state into a state that's not sleeping and is not waking. It somehow bridges those two states. And I now know that that's called the hypnagogic or hypnopompic state. And I can't tell which state I was in, but one is going to sleep when you're bridging into the dream world, and one is waking up when you're bridging into the dream world. And this was such a narrow window of time that it wasn't either, I think. But in that state, when I awakened, I could see the dream world. I could see this world, and it had characters I'd never seen before. It had landscape I'd never seen. It had architecture. There was a story with a huge narrative arc involved in it. I could see the characters individually. I could see the fabric on their clothing. I could see the way trees were not natural trees. There was some other kind of tree in that world. And I stayed in that world just observing it between about 2 o'clock in the morning until about 5:30 in the morning. And it was as though I was in a virtual reality. I could look to my left, I could look to my right, and I would see what was actually in this place. And my intention, because I'd been blocked for so long, was to try and capture as much of that within my memory as I possibly could. I felt that if I woke up, it would just evaporate. So I simply observed it. I tried not to move, and I took in this gigantic kind of download from I don't know where. And at about 5:30, when my wife Laura awakened, I said, would you bring me a pencil and paper, thinking I could get a few notes down. But once I started writing, I went back into that state, and I ended up, at the end of the day, I had something like 75 or 80 pages of material on this story, on this world. And I've been working on it ever since. That's 2005. So I've been working on this for almost 13 years, probably about 12 years now.
Well, in the same way that the story behind Three Fragments of a Lost Tale was somewhere between waking and dreaming, really the characters they're in this disquieting state between the familiar and the alien.
I think that's absolutely correct. It's always been my intention, and even before this project came about, I always wanted to create work that would not be time or place specific. I wanted to create characters that were, if at all possible, plugged into a deeper realm of human experience that's not really cognitive per se. I mean, it's not about thinking oneself into this world. It's about experiencing more archetypal elements within those characters without being specific. So when I create a figure, what I'm looking for is something that speaks to me of a meaningful human experience, which oftentimes I cannot communicate to another person except by the creation of that object. I believe that we have all of the arts specifically to be able to communicate things for which other forms of language are not capable of apprehending.
You've called this visual poetry.
I think of it very much as visual poetry or dance or music. I mean, when you go to hear a piece of music, especially a piece of classical music, no one sits there thinking, what does this mean? It means what it means. And I feel the very same way about my work. When people ask me, what does it mean? What is it about? And I said this in this film that I think you saw, it isn't about anything, which is not to say that it's meaningless. It's very meaningful to me when I see it, and it speaks in a language which is only accessible to people who simply let go of thinking. If you walk into my show, you'll find no labels. There's no description of what I'm trying to do. The best viewer simply opens him or herself to the experience of being with the work. And I think that I've been fortunate enough to see that that operate perfectly with people, where they come away not knowing why they've been moved to tears or why they've been affected by it. But that's what I want. I want that kind of nonverbal reaction to the work.
It seems to me that one of your inspirations may have been silent film. And back in the days before sound became a thing with film, back in the teens and 20s, there was more room for non-narrative expression in film. There was a lot more surrealism.
Yeah, absolutely. Early film, silent film, is definitely an influence and something I love very much. And in fact, there is an absolutely gorgeous version of Faust from 1926 by Murnau.
F.W. Murnau, yes.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that film to anyone who's interested in the subject or in silent film. It's just absolutely beautiful, and it goes to the heart of the story.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with sculptor, animator, composer, and visual artist John Frame. He's teamed up with Portland Opera and Lyric Opera of Chicago as one of the designers for their production of Faust. I think anybody who watches Three Fragments of a Lost Tale or goes to see a production of Faust that you're involved with the design of might say, well, this looks very steampunk. And steampunk has certainly been a trend in design for many years now. But in fact, this is a look that you have been fascinated with for decades, the early period of the Western Industrial Age. And I don't know if this has anything to do with the fact that your dad was a welder for the Santa Fe Railway, but you love these gears and these found objects, these hand-hewn, hand-built things that you've often employed in your design.
It does, I think, have something to do with the situation with my father. He was a real hands-on guy. he had a third grade education. We had a garage that was filled with tools and materials, and I was encouraged to go out there and just do whatever I felt like doing, aside from burning the place down or blowing it up, which I nearly did on a couple of occasions. But having the freedom to work with my hands as a child and just have develop a kind of dexterity at an early age was perhaps the start point. And ironically, when I went off to college, the last thing my father said to me was, "You're going to college so you don't have to work with your hands." Because he had just been a laborer his entire life, as had my mother. And so that was embedded in my thinking, and I was attracted to the arts when I first discovered them, because I'd been raised in an environment where I had zero exposure to any of the arts. There was no music, no dance, no poetry, no art. There was nothing, no visual art. So at college, I realized that it was a work of art. It happened to be a film by Ingmar Bergman that I saw at the age of about 17 and a half at college that absolutely changed my life, because there was something on a screen that so reflected my interior world that whatever that person was doing was what I wanted to do. It took me a lot of years to figure out that I was not a filmmaker out of the chute. I wasn't going to be a writer, and I was trying to figure out how to do all these things that created art without using my hands. And of course, the obvious answer, which took me nearly to the age of 30 to discover, was I would be a maker of objects. So back to the steampunk question, you're absolutely correct. It was the late 80s, early 90s when I started doing found object incorporation into the figurative elements of my work. And for whatever reason, I was in fact really attracted to the period of between about 1850 and about 1920. That's, you know, the industrial age is happening. There are a lot of handmade objects and machine parts that are just beautifully made and very interesting. And now they're in flea markets and yard sales and in dumps and wherever you can find them, but they have the patina of age on them. I think they're quite beautiful. In fact, some of them are so beautiful you have to be quite careful about putting them in the presence of one of my figures. They can actually override that. So I look to blend the two in such a way that you really can't tell which is which. And some of the quote-unquote found objects are actually things that I've made now that I've patinaed back to that same era. So I've tried to create a fabric both in terms of the color palette of the work and everything about it, which, as I mentioned earlier, I really want it to not read as a specific time or a specific place. It should be ambiguous in terms of where is it 20th century, 19th century, 16th century. I really want people not to know where it comes from. At the same time, I think it cannot be seen as other than contemporary. I think there's a feeling about the way the work is put together and the way that it looks that is definitely very of the moment. At least I hope so.
Well, one thing I think that has fueled the hand-hewn art movement, and you can call steampunk a part of that, is kind of a reaction to the digital age that we're in, where, you know, digital art is certainly a very important part of contemporary art, but at the same time, it so rarely involves your body, your hands, your arms, your torso, in the way that, say, Rodin or any of the sculptors of old with their epic works. And you've talked about how, in your art at least, there's a meeting of the head, the heart, and the hands.
Yeah.
In everything that you produce.
Yeah, that's certainly a guideline for me. When I was a young artist, I didn't know how to think about making art, and so I needed to formulate a system before I could even start in earnest. And I spent a bit of time in New York looking at work that really moved me, and I tried to understand what it was about those works that allowed that to happen, and came upon the idea that they all involve the head, the heart, and hand. The head is the intellectual part of life and of art making. The heart is the emotive content, and the hand is the use of the hands to create objects at a craft level. And craft has become kind of a negative word in the art world for the last probably 40 years now. But for what I wanted to express, I really felt that I wanted to deal with subtle human emotions, and I felt that I needed subtle skills to be able to do that, the skills of the hand to be able to do that. At the same time, I felt at every step of the way that I wanted to take maximum advantage of available technology, whether that was a power saw as opposed to a hand saw from 300 years ago, or now a computer software package that will allow me to create the music for one of my films or to create the films themselves. So I'm not anti-technology, I'm not anti-digital, and I'm not just pro-analog. I'm really interested in the blend of the two. ultimately both in service of human content. That's really the key for me. I think any artist can choose to use whatever materials and methods they want to use. Ultimately, it's not about those materials and methods. It's about who you are as a human being. Whoever you are, whatever you've made yourself into, that becomes the content of your work. It's as simple as that. It's who you are that will make your work.
And it's a question of balance. I mean, the hands feed back into the head and the heart. You know, doodling is inspirational. And one of the things that happens to Faust in the story with Mephistopheles is he's spent a life of being in his head, and now he's more embodied with the help of Mephistopheles.
Yes, and I think Kevin Newberry, our director, has really chosen to put a completely different spin on Faust's re-entry into the world of the young. He, of course, starts out as we think of him as being in his mid-60s or 70s, and he's transformed into a person in his perhaps 20s. And yet he is a person who has never experienced any of the things that are now open to his experience. He says he wants youth, he wants beauty, he wants all those things that he missed, but he has no basis for engaging those things. And so Kevin has drawn him as a person who's learning what is this stein that all these people on the floor are holding up in their hands. What's in that stein? Well, it's beer. He's never had that before. He doesn't know how to approach it. So he's very tentative about the way he begins to engage the world. And yet what happens right off the bat is his fundamental human lust begins to emerge. And he's not a person who's going to pass through his own kind of urges and find a logical solution with another person in the meeting of those urges. He relies on Mephistopheles to make that happen like this. And of course, that is the core problem. One of the core problems of the opera is that Faust gets a second shot at life, but he blows it a second time. All he does really is indulge his own lust. He causes the fall of an innocent woman, very contemporary subject right now. She never would have fallen had it not been for the presence of the devil. She is a victim of two men conspiring against her, and she's the hero of the story in many ways because she has goodness embedded in her. Faust and even Mephistopheles still have goodness in them. In Faust's case, every time his impulse is to be kind to Margarita, Mephisto steps in and pushes him away, pushes him more toward his more base instincts. And in the end, what happens to Faust is that he impregnates her and leaves her. And that's the story. And so she's left at the mercy of the community, which rejects her. She's rejected ultimately by her brother, who's her closest ally in life. She has no other siblings, no parents. It's her brother who she most deeply loves. He turns on her in the end. She is really solo in this story. And ultimately, her goodness, in the context of our story, her goodness overcomes everything else. She is the one who survives and goes on to something better.
Kevin Newberry, who directed this opera, he was definitely looking for more complexity to the story of Faust. And he brought his company from Santa Fe Opera, if I'm not mistaken, Vita Ciccun, mm-hmm. Fellow designer. And they sought you out. They definitely saw your work, your animation, your sculptures. They had worked on an opera about Steve Jobs in Santa Fe. And when they came to the Lyric, they wanted you to be on board for the set and production design.
Yeah, I think it works slightly differently than that. Chris Metagliano contacted Kevin and said, I'm interested in working with this artist and I want you to look at his work. And so Kevin looked at the work and shared it with Vita Ciccun and I believe David Adam Moore at that time. And when they looked at it, they decided that this would be an interesting thing to pursue. And on the other side of that, from the very first contact I had with Kevin, I felt that there was a kind of sympathetic relationship between the two of us, and that extended to each of the main creative personalities that came into this. So it was originally Kevin, and then Vita was our set and costume designer, then David Adam Moore, who became the video designer, and ultimately Duane Schuler, who was our lighting designer. So the five of us really have worked this as a collaborative event. It's really not accurate to describe me as the production designer. I think that my work is more the inspiration for the production. I did, in fact, create a lot of objects and set elements for it at the beginning. But when the team came to my studio in California, I just had the room filled with everything, the stuff that you saw here at the Portland Museum, the films, all the films, some things you've seen here, some things no one had seen. I just said, let's look at all of this material together and see what we can do. And wonderfully, one of Kevin's guiding principles is the best idea wins. I don't care where it comes from. I'm the director, and ultimately he does have the say, but he's really open to simply listening to everyone say what they think, you know, whatever their inspiration is, whatever their sense of direction for this thing was. We just started casting ideas around in my studio. It was really wonderful, a wonderful experience. And I've gotten very, very close to the team. It's really an important set of human relationships, never mind the opera, how successful or not it is. The experience of doing this with these people has been one of the highlights of my life as an artist.
Right. They came out and visited your studio in Southern California in the San Gabriel Mountains. And Kevin Newbery, the director, said, "The minute I walked into John's studio, I didn't want to leave. His entire imagination and worldview was in every single corner. It showed a deep sense of the complexities of human nature and had a real darkness met with a certain whimsy and humor. I had never seen anything like it."
Well, I'm really flattered to hear that. I certainly am endeavoring to create that kind of environment. It's a very, very personal world, and it's not simply the world of the objects that you see in a museum environment. The entire surround of my studio is just full of objects, some of which I've created, many of which I've found. It's a jam-packed, up to the ceiling and over the ceiling environment, and it just feeds my visual world in such a way that I can sometimes literally take one of those objects that I bought somewhere 20 years ago off the wall and incorporate it into what I'm doing. But the atmosphere is a really creative one for me, and I think it's one that fosters people's ability to see how this comes about in a larger context. And it was really, really important that when each of the team members came in, I think we all collectively knew that we could do something with this. And it just felt right from the beginning.
Now, in a certain way, this is coming around full circle for you, because before you started in visual art, before you started in painting and printmaking and then sculpture, you were fascinated with theater, and particularly the theater of Shakespeare. And Anthony Freud, who's the head of the Lyric Opera, said, "This is the first time John has designed for the theater, and yet on a different level, he has been designing for theater all his life. The world that he has spent years imagining is mysterious, romantic, sinister, and essentially a 19th century realm that I realized was a perfect fit for Gounod's Faust."
I think both Christopher Mataliano and Anthony Freud had that read on me, and I think it's an accurate read. I was, in fact, really, really attracted to the world of theater, especially Shakespeare, but also theater of the absurd. Samuel Beckett was, I wrote my senior thesis on Samuel Beckett. And so it was those two realms that I was just most attracted to. But I think more importantly, my experience, especially as a young artist, as a person discovering the arts, was that when I went into a theater, on most occasions, something powerful happened there. I saw something across the proscenium that moved me and oftentimes changed me, especially with Shakespeare and Beckett. Those experiences, again, had a kinship with what I saw in Ingmar Bergman's early films, especially the early black and white films. I was being moved in a way that made me want to move other people in that way. That's always been my aspiration. The way I've been touched and moved is what I want to do for others.
I've said half jokingly that the cinema is my church. But really, if you go back centuries through human civilization, the theater is a sacred space. It was in ancient Greece. These were stories of divine interaction with the human sphere. And the same goes for medieval Europe, where the mystery plays and the morality plays were immersive. There was no divide between the stage and the audience.
I think that's exactly right. I think that continues to be exactly right when film is done correctly. If it's done for those basic human purposes, if it really is searching and reaching and trying to touch people and trying to ask meaningful questions, it still does that. It's a logical extension of eight people in the desert someplace 8,000 years ago, getting together to tell some kind of a story that made the passage of time meaningful for them. I think that's what it's about. It's about creating these moments in our lives that are not the day-to-day. They're not One thing about the way I approach this is that this is not about entertainment. It's about something else. It's about a different approach. You can still call it entertainment, and I think our Faust actually is quite entertaining. But at its core, it's really about what you just described. It's people getting together to share stories, tell stories, invent stories, and that's what we're trying to do.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And I'm talking today with sculptor, animator, composer, and visual artist John Frame. He's teamed up with Portland Opera and Lyric Opera of Chicago as one of the designers for their production of Faust. There's sort of another way in which this production of Faust is a coming around for you, coming full circle, and that's that it's much more collaborative than your projects of a few years ago. And that harkens back to when you were first starting out in Los Angeles. You were part of a collaborative artists group called The Bastards. And it was called that because many of the works that you created together, they didn't have any clear parentage. One of your collaborators, John Swihart, he says that the Bastards grew out of this drawing group we have when we get together and draw from the model, would hang out afterwards and drink beer and talk. Naturally, we started collaborating on pieces, at first joking around, but as they became pretty good, we decided to formalize the Bastards. And these artists, they tended to be figurative, and being a figurative artist back in the 80s, the 90s, was not necessarily a cool thing.
It was absolutely not a cool thing. You could not see the figure being dealt with seriously in any of the art magazines or any of the big museums. It was just an outsider kind of a position to take. And I made a decision as I was leaving graduate school to be a figurative artist, knowing that there might not be a future for that, and still believing that if I was going to do art, I would do the art that I wanted to do rather than the art that would help to fit me into the existing system, which was very reductivist and very abstract. And so I just launched off on my own, making these little hand-carved figures that were, in the beginning, certainly very, very crude. Two things surprised me within about a year. One was that the audience was very prepared to see and respond to that. The audience in Los Angeles came to my show. They purchased the work. They supported me. I got more shows. And within a couple of years, I was starting to see the work of other artists who had clearly made the same decision. I didn't know any of these people. I remember John Swihart in particular. I went to a group show at a university, and there was this one jewel-like painting, unlike anything I'd seen in the period, unlike anything you would ever see in an art magazine. And I saw the name John Swihart, and it was already an incredibly accomplished painting, and I just wanted to get to know him. And so I sought him out. It's always a bit of a scary thing to seek out an artist whose work you respond to on a visual level and wonder if they will match that work. He matched it perfectly. And each of the artists in this group that we're talking about, I had that same coming to them experience of, what is this? This is not like what I'm seeing anywhere else. Who is this person? As we met and got together, we realized that we needed to spend more time together, that it was something I'd always aspired to when I began to realize that the art world had had these periods where artists collected in one place at one time, whether it was Paris in the 20s or New York in the 40s or some other time and place where something magic happened as a result of a group of artists being in the same place at the same time. Los Angeles, geographically and demographically, that does not happen naturally. You have to make that happen. And so my studio happened to be still a large studio. Almost everyone else was working in a much smaller space.
This was the Santa Fe Art
Collective?
This is
the Santa Fe Art Colony. Yeah. And so I had a bigger space, and we just started to, as John said, we started getting together to draw from the model, but it was more about conversation and camaraderie than anything else. And it was a group that kind of, you know, stretched out and shrank over the years. It was as big as 30 on a few occasions. Usually it was about a dozen of us, and it changed over time. But it became everything that I wanted that kind of a group to be. Interesting ideas were talked about. We had a lot of fun together. We drank a lot together. But ultimately, it was about supporting one another as active, growing artists.
One of the most prominent artists in the group, in the Bastards group, was F. Scott Hess, who brings sort of an old master's look to contemporary, you know, almost profane subject matter.
Yeah, Scott is really the only member of the group who's classically trained. He studied in Vienna for, I think, 6 years. I could be wrong about that. But he was definitely trained classically, so he knows all the techniques. He is... most of these, in fact, all of these people are masters of technique. There's no question in my mind, each one of them is. But he had the training, and yet he was taking that training and not reiterating the past. He was dealing with very dicey subject matter, very intense imagery. There's nothing soft about the way he treats the human form. It's powerful stuff. And I feel the same way. Each of the members of the Bastards in particular had a different approach to the creation of figuration. And they were different enough that when we started creating mashups among ourselves, just strange things happened. And the great thing about it was that we trusted one another enough that I would make an object or John would start a painting. We'd pass it off we'd just say, Scott, will you take this? Or, you know, Steve, will you take this? Michael, will you take this? And they took them. And we never knew what was going to come up from that, come out of that. But the results were really intriguing. And I think more importantly, I, for one, learned a lot from that experience. Watching other artists work on something that I had created and vice versa, it really taught me something deeper about what each of those artists was actually doing in their work. It was a wonderful experience, as is this one with Faust. I'm learning so much, and it's a very different collaboration, but it's similar to that group in the sense that everyone brings a special set of skills to the table and is enormously generous in sharing those skills.
You know, I've heard of jams in jazz and writing and even comics creation, but this is the first time I've heard of a painting jam.
It is a bit of that. Last night we got together for drinks after rehearsal, and there is that present in it, and it's very exciting to at least throw around the idea of a more formal jam, you know, where we'd get together for 10 days or 2 weeks and just see what happens. No agenda, no pre-thought, anything except let's get together and enjoy one another's company, drink a lot of scotch, and see what happens. And I would love to do that.
So Kevin Newbery and the opera crew came out to your workshop, and they found many characters, masks, figures that they really liked. But you also created a whole host of new images and new characters for this production of Faust. One of the things that people are really responding to are these demonic assistants of Mephistopheles that are on stage, crowding around him wearing oversized masks.
Yes, I created, before I was ever under contract to do the opera, I became so interested in Faust that I just allowed myself to create whatever interested me. So I ended up with about 20 characters. I did two versions each of Faust and Mephistopheles, so I have six of those characters. Then I created about a dozen devil characters. There's a section in an earlier version of the opera called Walpurgisnacht, and it's the Night of the Witches, in which Faust is taken down into the underworld kingdom of Mephistopheles, and all these devils and strange characters are roaming around. So I just riffed on that. I just kept going, creating these images. By the time the team got to the studio, those 20 images were there, and there were maybe 10 set pieces that were also created for this. And again, they just became a part of the array of things that I had created. And I didn't say, well, I made this for Faust, so it has to be in Faust. I just said, here are all these things. What do you guys think about which one will work? And so if you'd seen the exhibition in Portland, you will see a lot of images that were in the show. The main character was a central character in the show up here. Many of the films were a part of the show up here. They were chosen without any sense of, oh, they've been used or they've been seen somewhere else. They've been chosen on the basis of, will they work in the context of this particular production? And I think the choices are correct. Of course, when the show opened in Chicago, I've never been seen there, so no one had any kind of point of reference for what this was going to look like. In Portland, there's a different audience awareness, assuming some of the people who saw the show actually come to the opera. I hope they will, by the way. So it's a kind of revisitation. And when I talked with the team about it, David Adam Moore said, you know, I think people like to see something where there's something familiar. The story is completely different from the story that I would tell in my own work without the context of Gounod's opera and the libretto that's below it or runs through it. So it's a very different mix. And I think out of all of the work that I created for this, including film, we've perhaps used certainly less than 10% of what I made, maybe closer to 5. Three of the devils that you just mentioned with these oversized masks are made directly from three pieces that I created for Faust. And the fourth one was something that we took from an earlier piece that I'd made. So they are They are, they're just an interesting addition. I mean, I've never seen a Faust that had this sort of character added to the picture, and they animate the action in a very intriguing way, I think.
Well, lest anybody think that everything on stage in this production is all leather and wool and wood and metal, there's actually some very sophisticated video that's integrated into the story, and you've projection mapped a skeleton army, for example, at one point during the opera.
Yes, David Adam Moore is our projection designer, and it worked exactly in the way the rest of the production worked, in that when he came to California, I had huge files of all of these different films, which no one has ever seen. And I just said, take them with you. So he took them off my hard drive, took them with him to New York, and he began to assemble some things. And he also, I have to say, he added his own imagery that's not from me at all, that fulfills the purpose of the opera. It's not about, oh, we have to use John's work for every bit of this. No, it's really about furthering the story and making it a beautiful experience to be inside this story. So he took all of that, and when he came back to California to spend about 10 days with me really formalizing the video components, I liked what he had done, but in the meantime, I had also done something new, which was I began to be very interested in the use of silhouettes and shadows and animation. That's something, when they were first in the studio, everybody got really excited. David brought a little Pico projector and started doing projection mapping, which is a technology where you can throw an image from a projector onto just one thing. It can be a ball, it can be a piece of a wall, it can be the entire stage. So you can really control that very, very carefully. So in the studio, all of us saw these shadows being created by the technology, and the shadows were as interesting or more interesting than what was being mapped. We all got very excited about that, and after they left, I thought, how can I use this? So, for example, in one case, I created a silhouette cutout that has a skeleton in it, and one of our devils will throw a shadow up, you put a light behind that and throw a shadow on the wall. That was the point of origin of my thinking about what was going to happen. So then I created the same exact skeleton in a silhouette cutout, a black cutout, and I created an animation table, a light table, on which I could animate those cutouts. So I began to create characters that were from Faust or from my vision of Faust, what I understood about Faust, and to animate them in these very simple, very minimal stop-motion animation sequences. And when he was there and I showed them to him, we both got really excited about incorporating them. And while he was there actually beginning to feather these things into the production, I was out in the studio all day continuing to do that. So I would work out there for 12 hours while he was doing all the tech side in the house. And at the end of the day, I would have a very short clip, maybe just a few seconds, and he would take that and run with it. So the things that you see in the video side, those are really David's work. And of course, he's taking my work as the jumping off point, but he is the video designer.
That's amazing. That's true creative feedback. Some people might label that as accidental art, but that's really just paying attention to the process.
It's absolutely paying attention. I think we all of these team members agree absolutely in the happy accident. You know, the thing that nobody anticipated, it just, you see a light on the wall that just goes, pops and goes, you just, wow, that is beautiful. I think a lot of people would say, yeah, but that's not what we're doing. And whereas in this group, when there's a happy accident, and it's happened repeatedly in the course of actually assembling the production, I think more so here in Portland than even in Chicago, this is an entirely different space. It's shallower. It's a different type of hall. So nothing looks the way it did there. And as a result, it's kind of opened us up to it again. And there have been several of those happy accidents where I think a lesser director or a lesser set and costume designer would have just said, no, that's not what we're doing. We're doing this. This is what I want to do. We see that. Any one of us sees it and says, look at that. And everybody says, oh, God, that's great. Or, no, that's a bad idea. It can go either way. But the important thing is that there's a willingness on the part of, especially Kevin, to be open to something that occurs in the creative act. And I really appreciate that about him. He is truly a giving person in the role of director.
Well, there's more information about this production of Faust at portlandopera.org, and it continues through Saturday the 16th of June.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I really appreciate being here. I love Portland so much. I'm so happy to be back in this town.
I'm really grateful that you gave up this much time because I know it's been crazy busy.
It has been a really intense experience. The last 4 days, we were in the theater, the auditorium, between 9 and 10 in the morning, and we were off at about 11:30 at night, all four nights. So it's been those are really long days, but when you have the crew together, all the singers, the orchestra, you have to really maximize what you can get out of that. So in the morning, we're working on physical things, you know, set components that have to be addressed, or Vita and I were actually up drawing on, there are these oversized easels, and in Chicago, they didn't quite read correctly, so we've been up there on ladders drawing, you know, filling in some of these things that are my drawings, but now they're blown up quite large, and we sort of personalize them with our own hands, and that's been really fun. That kind of thing I just love doing, and it's been a remarkable experience. It'll be something I remember throughout my life.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And my guest today has been sculptor, animator, and visual artist John Frame. He's teamed up with Portland Opera and Lyric Opera of Chicago as the designer for their production of Faust. John, it's been great to have you join us today on Words and Pictures.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much, Konser.
And now for our listeners who might be interested in your personal projects, how can they find out more?
They can certainly go directly to my website, johnframesculpture.com, or they can Google my name with artist, sculptor, or pretty much anything behind it, and they'll come to me. And also, you can link from the website to the Vimeo page. Part of what I've been doing with this project is that the films that I generate, I give away for free. I do not sell them. You can get a DVD if you want, but it's really about making everything available as I create it.
Well, thanks again, and thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.fm. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.